Like, there was no toilets to it because no one listened to this year, the recordings.
I'm going to figure out a way. Yeah, I'll figure out a way to make the recordings more useful. We have to figure out the dynamic. There's a lot of wisdom in this room. There's a lot of people. No, no, I'll stop that right now. So we'll have to figure it out because a lot of people from a lot of different places. The shir won't be for everybody. Yesterday when I, in the shul, there was a chabura, and we, the shul, when we finished up, we made a kiddush. So someone came up to me and spent like a whole 5 minutes explaining to me why he left the shir and blah, blah, blah. If it's not for you, that's fine. We're cool. We're happy. You're here. We're happy. And if you're not here, then more power to you. Fine. So that's that. Now, one thing that I really do try to do in Olam Mishnayos the whole way through is try to prepare the content and prepare you to hear the content by laying out the principles that are at work prior to engaging the Mishnah. So that although we learn every Mishnah inside, the text is of course read inside and we read the Mishnah carefully and so, but that comes at the end. What usually happens at the beginning is I try to frame for you what's bothering the Mishnah, what the Mishnah is coming to address, and then try to lay out ahead of time whatever, you know, principles that are not evidence in the text of the Mishnah, or that if you didn't know coming to the Mishnah would make the Mishnah very difficult. So the goal is, by the time we start the Mishnah already, you sort of know it already, at least outside, and you're ready to just hear it, and then the words just, so to speak, words, more or less, as opposed to the other way around, where if you jump into the forest first with all the words and try to figure out how it fits together, it's much more difficult. So that's the approach to the Mishnahs. It's worked out okay so far. Like I said, we have returning customers after 8 years, so it can't be that bad. But it's not for everybody, and some people found it quite slow or frustrating, whatever it is. Our pace needs to be, if we're going to do the five-year thing, around 3.5, something like that, Mishnayos a day on average. Our average, long-term average over 8 years, if you do the math, was about 2.5 last time around a day. So you see how that goes. We did, just for example, to illustrate the point, in the course of the last cycle through, we spent 6 weeks giving a hakdama introduction to Seder Taharos before we opened the Mishnayos. We spent 6 months on Pirkei Avos, and we did a bunch of Tziurim. So I don't know if that'll happen this time around, but I'm just giving you a picture that the shir has its own flavor, and you know, I hope you like it, and if you do, great. What I did for today, because everything has an introduction, we have to go through some heavy-duty introduction material, and this is the material I'm giving today. It's in English. Everything will be in English. If I say something in Hebrew and you don't catch it, then ask me to say it in English or ask. You can ask that kind of question, interrupt me for sure. So we start with the very beginning is just what is Mishnah? What is the Mishnah? Two different questions. What I wrote for you here is, so to speak, if you would be diligently taking notes, this is what you should be writing down. But I'm saving the efforts of writing down the notes. This is the lecture notes from what I'm going to tell you now. So you don't have to write them down. You can listen to me, and you'll have that for paper afterwards. And their mar makomos are at the bottom. I didn't want to, just too cumbersome to print out source sheets times 30 and all these things. I don't want to do it. But I do want to give you a big picture introduction to Mishnah, which is very important. So that's what we begin like that. Then after that, we'll introduce, after the Mishnah, we'll introduce Seder Zeraim, we'll introduce Brachos, we'll introduce Kriyat Shema, and then sometime midweek we should convene and commence on the first mission there. Everyone got a copy? It's really just for takeover. You don't even know. You can listen to me now, and that's that. Okay. So people, I think, step one, people think that the Torah is divided into two parts, Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebaal Peh, but that is not how Chazal saw it. Chazal saw that the Torah had three parts to it. There's Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, which would be the 24 books of the Tanakh. There's the Torah Shebaal Peh, which is the content that, let's call it, Moshe Rabbeinu brought down from Har Sinai, although it's a little more expansive than that because Moshe Rabbeinu also brings with him these Midos, Shetor, Nedresh, the ways in which the Torah can be extrapolated. And during Bai Shemi time, there was a great deal of extrapolation going on, so there's a lot more Torah Shebaal Peh that expands that way. The very famous Gemara in Menachos, it's in the Chavtes, I think, where Moshe Rabbeinu asks, what's with the Tagin, the little like letters, crowns on the Sefer Torah, and Hashem shows him Rabbi Akiva, the darshaning mountains of halachas from the Tagin, and poor Moshe Rabbeinu sitting in the eighth row back, I think it's the eighth row back, which is meaning that he was like, you know, not even the second or third or fourth string, it was like eighth string, that's Moshe Rabbeinu, and like, you know, wasn't invited to sit with them, and he was very distraught that what's going on, until, says the Gemara, until Rabbi Akiva says, and everything that we got here, we got from Moshe Rabbeinu. That sort of was that gave Moshe some heart. I think the Pasha Pshat, it's worth considering, what is Pshat in the Gemara? I think Pasha Pshat is like this. In any rules-based system, if you allow, you set up rules and say, take those rules and run with it, so then, of course, you can build upon those rules and get more and more and more. So the simplest example I can give you, just to start off, is if I teach you basic arithmetic, right, and so you know how to add and subtract, so then I never taught you what 4 plus 7 is, it's really not what 4 million plus 7,271 is, but you can figure it out given the tools you have, and it would be reasonable to say that I taught you the sum 4 million plus 7 whatever, because I gave you all the information that's actually contained in that sum is already existent when I taught you the rules. It's a matter of taking the rules and running with them, expanding them. I think a better example than that I gave you is, if you're familiar with Euclid, laid out five rules on which all of geometry is based. And if you speak English, so you have a set of grammatical rules you have, and you have a lexicon of, you know, words you're familiar with, and you can take that and make unlimited number of sentences, and so on and so forth. So any system that has rules, you can take those rules and apply them and expand. That's the enterprise of philosophy, it's the enterprise of the natural sciences. You know, you learn physics, and then you can take those ideas and build new contraptions with the same ideas. The rules of nature aren't changing, the rules of physics aren't changing. What you learned in your engineering course didn't change, but you can come with bigger and better bridges or faster and better computers applying those same rules. So something similar happened to the Torah. Hashem gave a set of rules, both a set of contents, let's call the Torah, but we, you know, don't eat milk and meat together. And then he also gave a set of rules to extract further halakhos from the Torah. The midos turn and dress then. So the Torah, Sheba'al Peh, expands. But that's still content. It's just information. There's also another layer. I'm not going to deal with this layer at all, but there's a separate layer of Durabanans. When Anshei Knesset Gedola, when the second temple period began, and they came back there to Israel, so Anshei Knesset Gedola took a position of, as the Mishnah says it in Avos, Asus Yag LaTorah. They felt it was important to make protective fencing to protect the Dine Doraisa, and the answer, a great deal of effort, like of by a shiny time of Chazal, were to make protective fences, lots of durabanas, lots of gazeras. So that also becomes part of Torah Sheba'al Peh, but I don't want to conflate, I don't want to make a cholent between the Torah's Torah Sheba'al Peh and then the rabbinic stuff. That's not what I mean right now. The Mishnah makes them together. Our Mishnah, what we call Mishnah, of course, has dinim durabanan, obviously. But in terms of what Torah Sheba'al Peh is in pristine form, it's Moshe Rabbeinu's principles from Har Sinai, as well as a set of rules how to expand and decode the Torah text, which will come to Moshe Rabbeinu over the next 40 years. Then there's a third category called Gemara, or Talmud. And the Gemara is not capital G Gemara, the text, but the notion of Gemara, Talmud, learning, is thinking about those principles. Thinking about those principles. And when you think about those principles, you can have deductions and inferences and applications of those principles, and that is much of what the Talmud is doing. So the Talmud has two separate things. I don't discuss it so much today. We're not learning Talmud, we're learning Gemara. But the Talmud sometimes is using Yud Gimel Midos, let's call them, and it's sort of, this is our Gemara Shira. This is what's a little crazy on the board now, so maybe it doesn't matter. But things like Klalu Prat and Ribu and Miyot. So when the Torah is taking the Gemara, taking Psukim and unraveling them, Gemara will record how that works. But that's still in the world of Torah Sheba'al Peh. But other times, like if you ask a question like, I don't know, is cooking in a microwave oven called Bishul on Shabbos? You know, so that is not something that the Mishnah discusses. And no one's going to say there's a drasha, you know, that the word Bishul, extra vav, comes to add microwave oven. That's not what's going on there, of course. It's that you have a set of principles, and you now have to figure out how they apply in the real world or how they would not be applicable and so on and so forth. So that, those extrapolation of principles to apply halacha in the real world, that is the enterprise of Talmud, different from Torah Sheba'al Peh. So there's three separate things then. You have the 24 canonized books, the five from Moshe Rabbeinu, and you have 19 more at Tanakh. I'm not discussing that today anymore. You have the principles that Moshe Rabbeinu came down with from Har Sinai, Torah Sheba'al Peh, which is also referred to as Mishnah, but with a lowercase m, so to speak. Not the Mishnah, but just Mishnah. And then there's a third thing called Gemara, which is thinking about that content and deciding how it applies and what its inferences are and what, you know, the hashkafic and halachic ramifications are. Three separate things. Okay?
Sorry?
No. One second. Hold that thought. There's no mention. Brisa doesn't belong anywhere in the discussion because I haven't discussed any text or anything. I'm not using any capitalized terms ever. So the three categories of Torah study. Okay? The three separate categories of Torah study. Okay. The Torah Shebaal Peh and its implications, the Gemara, always were intended to stay oral. That was the original intention. And the written part is obviously has to be kept written because the writings are very specific. Each letter is very specific. And the Gemara in Yitin, Daf Samach, says that essentially that there's an Isser from the Torah, to write down Torah Shebaal Peh. Anyway, it must remain oral. That was the vision originally. I think the reason why is pretty obvious, because if you have the Torah Shebaal Peh is meant to be something that is real life and applicable and understood contextually. So context will change over the course of generations, the world will change, people will change. The very famous Gemara, which I think is remarkable. There's a famous Gemara in Tanya, it says, Choni Yamagel, he asks about these carob trees being planted, and why are you planting carob trees? You want to see the fruit in your lifetime, and the person who plants them says, oh, it's because the people who came before me planted, so I'll plant for the next generation. Beautiful Gemara, I'm not discussing that part of the Gemara. Then Choni Hashem shows Choni a thing or two, and Choni falls asleep for 70 years. And when he wakes up, so he finds the carob tree, but leave that alone, he goes back to his old base of Middush, and he hears people saying, oh, like, if only we had the good old days, like, when Choni was here, you could answer our questions. Choni was the good old door. And he says, I'm Choni, and they say, ah, come on, because he's been missing and gone for 70 years. Anyways, eventually he can't convince them. He has no one to talk to, he has no one to learn with, and Hashem has Rahmanis on him, and he dies. Choni dies. It's quite a sad story. But the story has there's an obvious question, which is, but he was Choni, and he did have that information, so what the heck? Why couldn't he, when they said, we have questions, okay, so let him not be Choni, let him be Shmerel, but he's Shmerel with all the answers. He's still the Gadol Hador from 2 generations ago. Why did no one listen to him? Why? It doesn't make sense. So the Gemara's pushed answer is just this, that Torah has relevance contextually, and if you read the most popular Torah writings from 100 years ago, you try to read Hirsch. Read Hirsch. Even if you don't read Hirsch in German, because you wrote in German, but if you read the best English translation of Hirsch, Hirsch was so, at the vanguard and so, hip and with it, and so, meant to be, friendly to the reader and applicable to the everyman and writing to teenagers. That's what you read the 19 letters, he's writing letters to teenagers. If you read that, you'll be like, who the heck wants to read this? You see for yourself, because Hirsch is 100 years ago. You see what happens in 100 years. It won't speak to you one bit. It's a different language. Of course, it's the same Torah, and it's meant to be applicable, but people change and times change, and Torah is meant to be alive and dynamic and apply to people in their time and place, and it can't be boxed in. I think that's also a push-up shot, by the way, in the famous Gemara in Shabbos, where it talks about Shamtei Kvaraschem, that if you don't accept the Torah, it'll be... So I think the shot there, I don't want to go too much now, is that if you're stuck in one place, then that becomes, because Hashem, there will be your burial spot. Point of view, if you don't accept this dynamic component of it, that the Torah Shebaal Peh part, then you are stuck in time and it becomes your grave. I think that's what's out there, the Sham. In any case, so that being the case, Torah is meant to remain oral and are meant to be applicable in every generation, and it was the Rebbe's job to make sure that the Talmud heard it in his language. And the Mishnah talks about cows, because in those days, that's what people had running around their backyards, cows and goats. Nowadays, we wouldn't talk about cows, we talk about, robots will be around and their mountain bikes and their, whatever it is. There are these little funny things they stand on that they zip on, whatever those things are called, hoverboard, yeah, and so on and so forth. Obviously, cows, I know one of my teachers, Yitzhak Berkowitz, told me he learned I don't remember exactly what he said, but he said basically he learned the Mishnah Bava Kamma 100 times, whatever he said exactly, and he didn't know what a cow even looked like. Understand? Because it doesn't even, look, grew up in Brooklyn, but it doesn't matter. The point is, it's like you're responsible for your, what? You're responsible for your objects, and they go around, and these objects are docile, these kind of creatures aren't docile. It doesn't matter what it looks like, so to speak. It's abstract. But, in Moshe Rabbeinu, and so on and so forth. So that was the intention. The problem was that to learn Torah Shebaal Peh, if you have an actual set of information, and you want to pass it on to the next generation, it requires quite a lot of study. And the Torah was big. Is big. So even in its reduced associated with Torah version, it's still Torah is massive, obviously. And to not write it down means you have to memorize. So that content, Torah Shabbat Peh, became called Mishnah with a lowercase m, not the Mishnah, not our Mishnah, but called Mishnah because the word Mishnah means, oh, what a happy thing to see you. Welcome back. How are you?
Good, good, thanks.
Oh, look, there's a seat right up
here. Oh, great. That's great. Right. Front row
seat. Front. Front. That's it. That's it. That's great. You missed the CM last night. But okay, next time. 5 years. Put it in your calendar. Really.
If I may.
So, I lost my train of thought. Oh, Mishnah, lowercase m. Yeah, so the word Mishnah means, like, the word, like, shoneh is to teach, but also to repeat. Like, kol ha-shoneh halachot, whoever repeats or learns Mishnah. The word, like, sheni, too. And shoneh is to both teach and also to repeat, because the way that they would learn and teach all this Mishnahs and keep them, retain them, was by repetition, memorization. So that became the Mishnah, the repeated, memorized part of Torah. And it's massive. And it would require, like, you know, a lifetime of dedication, or at least much of a lifetime, to memorize the Mishnah. That worked out just fine for a long time. And actually, tomorrow, my hope is I'm going to actually present to you both the Rambam and Rashi's version of the story here. This is very important. What I'm saying is very important. And I'll bring them inside English and Hebrew, Be'ez Hashem, tomorrow. But I want to say the story in the Gadol right now. If you have calm life, then you can dedicate years and years to study and memorization. But if you're being persecuted, then not. What happened was, making a long story short, around the turn of the millennium, meaning around the time of Hillel and Shammai, like what's called the year zero, okay, plus minus, Hillel and Shammai set up two different schools. They had different approaches to life. That wouldn't have been a problem at all. The problem is, in concert with these two kind of approaches to Jewish thinking and Jewish living, there was heavy-duty Roman oppression, okay, which only got worse and worse and worse. It culminated the first time with the Chorban Bayis, like called the year 70, the first destruction. But leading up to that was bad times. But that was just the beginning. After that, things got much worse. After the Jews caused such a problem to the Romans in the first Jewish war, as it's called, the Romans had an ongoing series of different sort of rules and restrictions to limit and sort of weaken the Jews. The most famous Hadrianic persecution period, that was what fomented the Bar Kokhba revolt, like 60 years later in the year 132. But in the middle also, under Trajan, this fellow Quietus, Domitian, there were also terrible to the Jews, and there were ongoing Roman edicts against learning Torah, and just in general, making Jews' life miserable. And that being the case, you have the problem of not being able to have peace and quiet to sit and memorize and learn your Mishnayos. And the problem was that, because of that, it became much more fractious and disagreed upon what was the Torah Shabbat Peh. When life was calm, there was always people disagreeing. That's the Jewish thing to do. But when you have a base, and we have the first and even the second base in Mikdash time, you have this Sanhedrin set up and you have sort of order in your society. So you can have a disagreement, and then if it's sort of brought up to the Supreme Court, the Bez and the Gadol ultimately, even if there's a split opinion, what's with microwave ovens on Shabbos? They take a vote, they go after the majority, and then they sort of settle the issue. So in other words, there are two ways to look at microwave ovens on Shabbos, let's say for example, but you know what? We had a vote and 40 said it is bishul and 30 said it's not bishul, so we go with the majority, and case closed. So that collapses the ambiguity, right? And then all of a sudden, going forward, we've considered it, and we've Bezdin, Agadol, Sanhedrin, Paskin, then now we have one way to go. So that's how you can sort of, even though you can have a machlokas, but you can sort of close the gap every time. But if you just have two ways of thinking about things and no one can agree on anything, and there's so many different versions of what's going on, and you haven't got a Sanhedrin that can be in safety, peace and quiet to consider the matters, the problem is that different traditions and different opinions start proliferating. And that's what happened. After Hillel, the way that there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says what happened was Lo Shimshu Kol Tzarchan, that there was not enough Ashimash Talmidei Chachamim, that the students of Hillel and Shammai and those two academies didn't discuss. Shimash was hard to translate exactly. Didn't have enough practical experience discussion to flesh out what they were learning from their teachers, and that's because of that they lots of different opinions and ambiguities and lack of clarity sprung up. It got worse and worse and worse. Especially after that second Jewish war, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, people don't realize that from a spiritual point of view, the Chorban Bayis Rishon was worse. But But from a like political, social, you know, material, physical point of view, it's very possible that the Bar Kokhba revolt was actually worse. Certainly it was much worse for the morale of the Jews. In terms of numbers of Jews killed, I don't know, but it could have been worse also at this, I don't know. But it was terrible, terrible. And because it was, you know, the 1-2 knockout, so the second one was terrible. And the Jews coming out of the Bar Kokhba revolt and its quashing really sort of thought that they thought maybe this was the end. That was the early Christians who were contemporaries of that time, we were Jews. Don't forget, early Christians were Jews. So their argument was, you see, God has abandoned us, Chas v'Shalom, and at the time for, you know, whatever, then the gospel and so on and so forth. That was the argument. The primary argument that was levied to the, not against, the Christians didn't succeed much, the Jews, the Christians really succeeded in, like, you know, in Greece and in Turkey, where there were pagans and they were ripe for monotheism. But by the Jewish world, less successful, much less successful. But the primary argument, how do you convince Jews to sort of jump Mamalash in the tradition and go with this crazy newfangled idea? The answer was, the proof is in the pudding. You see, God has abandoned us. You see, we must be wrong. We denied what Yashka said and blah, 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 and see, we got our just dessert. That was the argument that was being made. And people believed that because it was so terrible. What else, how else? No, it's like, imagine, God forbid, two Holocausts back to back. That's what it was like. So sort of like the end, you know, if you were living in the year 140, you probably thought that this was, you know, you were the last, you know, you thought you were like Reb Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave, so to speak, if you were a Torah true Jew, like people in the Holocaust, I'd say, sure, people live in little caves and under buildings and so on, but they must thought they're the last remnants of the Jewish people. As it happened, Hashem didn't let that happen, of course. He arranged things that, although that long sequence of terrible, terrible anti-Jewish sentiment came from the Romans who controlled Israel. In the year 161, approximately, there Marcus Aurelius. This is a little confusing. There's a fellow named Antoninus Pius. He was the emperor of the Roman Empire. Okay, he adopted a son whose name was Marcus Aurelius. It took the name Aurelius, whatever. And Marcus Aurelius. His full name was Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. In Kavod, yeah, Marcus Anthony. So the Mark Anthony, exactly. So Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, which is the name that's often forgotten, he took it as sort of like a Kavod to his like patron. The way they did it is they sort of adopted kids, so like his father, adopted father. The history, we call him Mark Anthony or Marcus Aurelius, and the Antoninus has fallen away. The Gemara refers to him as Antoninus, so there's a little confusion who Antoninus is, but Antoninus, by the dating, only works. It's Marcus Aurelius. And Marcus Aurelius was a famous the philosopher king. And Adiyomazeh is considered to be one of the great philosophers of the Western tradition, the Roman emperor, really. Meditations he wrote. So in any case, this part of the world, the whole Mediterranean basin, which were on the east coast, was controlled by the Romans. But just the east of us, which were the Babylonian Jews were, there was the Parthian Empire. The Parthians were ongoing fighting with the Romans. This was an ongoing problem. And they ended up starting up, Parthians starting with the Romans, if they thought that they had a chance. And in any case, the Romans put it down. In about 165, plus minus, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, he was coming across to Syria to see his troops and so on and so forth. And on the way back, he passed back to Israel, on the way back home. And there he met Reb Yehuda Nasi, who was the Gadol Hador, the Nasi. His name is okay. So, his Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi was a descendant of Hillel. Maybe tomorrow I'll write on the board how he came is from Hillel. But between Hillel down to Rebbe Nasi, there's a number of generations. It's Shimon, Gamliel, Shimon, Gamliel, Shimon. So that's five generations. Yeah, and then the Hillel is before and Yehuda is after. So Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi is Rebbe Yehuda ben Shimon, but he's called Hanasi, the prince, because he was the leader of the Jewish people, and he was something extraordinary. The Gemara comments how it was the last time you saw Torah and Gedula together, that you had Torah content and also sort of political leadership or something like that, royalty together. He wasn't the king in any way, because the Jews were heavily under the thumb of the Romans, but he really was like a figurehead, which he was a great statesman, was respected by the Roman Empire, remarkably. And he found that the Gemara talks about a number of discussions, apparently, that he, Rebutinus, he had with Antoninus. Many, many Gemara like that. And sometimes you see where Antoninus was actually, where Rebbe said, you know, you're right, and he retracted his position. So they had a relationship. And although, in the beginning, the Romans thought to keep the Jews under control, because they wanted free passage between through Israel to get to and from Parthia. There's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Yotess that says basically that they wiggled out of it quickly. The Jews wiggled out of it quickly, and they didn't have restrictions. And because Marcus Aurelius Antoninus was well disposed to Rebbe and the Jews, so the Jews sort of had like a total respite. So after like 100 years of like heavy duty, relentless persecution, they had like calm, and sort of freedom to maneuver. And Rebbe saw that this was the big opportunity. As the famous Rav Shmuel Leal says, like, who's the chacham or esanolad, if you're wise, if you can see the future. Rebbe saw that even if Antoninus, who was like a, let's call him an alliance emperor, already had initially put on restrictions on the Jews, that they should basically free them from learning Torah, and they wiggled out of it, that for sure it's going to come back again soon, and if he should seize this opportunity to sort of protect the Torah Shvah Peh from being lost. So he acted against the Isser of writing down the Torah Shvah Peh, and he wrote down the Torah Shvah Peh. Okay? Tomorrow I will show you inside the Bez Hashem, the exact the versions as Rashi presents it and as the Rama presents these stories, but that's the important gist of it. So the Gemara is actually very bothered by, like, and they were all bothered by at the time, how can you write it down? So the Gemara says that, yeah, Eis Lasos Lashem, basically sometimes you have to act for God because they have, one shot is also one shot for now, since they have acted to be mefir Torah, to sort of annul the Torah, you have to act to do something extraordinary. It's a tricky, obviously slippery slope, but anyways, Rebbe did it, and he was, history has shown he did the right thing. So what did he do? He basically gathered together all the chachamim from around the country to his Bezdin. Rebbe's interesting. He started a new place. He removed the Sanhedrin to a new place called Beit Sharim. He wanted a fresh start. He invited everyone down there, everyone being, I don't know, the Rosh Yeshiva, whatever it is, the Gedolim of his time. And he got them to each say over their version of the story of Torah Shvah Peh, and they sort of ironed out all the wrinkles. That's what happened, really. And they decided to make a single set of teachings of everyone's lowercase Mishnah, everyone's teaching they memorized, and to make sort of a formalized official set that would be for everyone to learn. There's a machlokus in Rashi and the Rambam, and most go with Rashi here, that actually was never written down. It wasn't written down in this generation. It stayed oral, taught orally. That's where Rav Shira Gaon learns. Rav Shira Gaon is the first that we know of who wrote down this story, if you will, and Rav Shira lived in the 10th century, so he preceded the Rambam by 200 years, and Rashi by 100 years. And so Rav Shira seems to have had the upper hand, if you will, in telling the story, and most Rishonim learn like that. Most Rishonim learn that the Torah Shebaal Peh, although it was like there was a definitive set created by Rav Yudin Nasi called the Mishnah, but it was not a written book. It wasn't a written book. And you'll see, I'll show you tomorrow, Bez Hashem, you'll see Rashi learns that wasn't a written book. It was just still taught the same way, just at least we have a definitive set. We can all agree upon something. So what Rebbe did is he basically said, listen, Rebbe he preferred the version of teachings of Reb Meir. Reb Meir was one of the scholars, and I think he was. Rebbe Meir was the greatest in his generation, so they say. And he, I guess his Mishnayos were clear. Reb Meir was a student of Rebbe Akiva. Okay, so Rebbe Meir's teachings became the primary, like the primary source material for the Torah Shebaal Peh's Rebbe's Mishnah, but not always. So the way Rebbe Yudin Nasi set up the Mishnah was, he basically, if there was a consensus or he felt comfortable rejecting other opinions, he taught a Mishnah, what's called the Stam Mishnah. He said, just doesn't say who said it, he just says the din is such and such. That is typically Rebbe Meir's version of the story, unless not. And that's Rebbe Yehudin Nasi's intention of saying, this is the halacha. There's a Mishnah in Edius that says, why did Rebbe even include the other opinions? Like, because oftentimes the Mishnah says, you can't do this, and Rebbe Yehuda says, you can do it. So why did he include that you can if the halacha says you can't? And the Mishnah itself says, because we want you to know that we consider this opinion and we've rejected it. You understand? It's not the pshat that it's like a, Bidiyavid you can rely upon. That's not what's going on there. At least according to how Rabbi Yochanan and his basement learned it, and that's how we'll stick to that shot right now with the Mishnayos. That the halacha typically goes like the Tanna Kamma. That was Rebbe's intention. And the Das Yachid, the individual opinions, are actually telling you, we heard this story, we're aware this is floating around out there, these urban myths, but no, it's not the halacha. What I said now is a bit of a mouthful, and it's like ripe for kashas. I'll tell you why. First of all, the halacha doesn't follow the Mishnah lots of times. That's A. So, and B, there's a separate notion of Elu v'Elu Divrei Elokim Chaim. So I'm not grappling with those issues at all now. I'm just saying the gist of what the Mishnah is setting up. The gist is that Rebbe intended this should be clear what the halacha is in the single Masorah, and he's including other opinions to tell you no. Since the Talmud Bavli has like, even the Yerushalmi, but the Bavli sort of has like super ordinance over it's trumps the Mishnah, and it was intended to be a more halachic work. Many times they'll say you can't pass it for a Mishnah, and you know we're going like Rava, and Rava disagreed with Tanakhama. That happens all the time. But Rebbe was only Rebbe, and Rebbe gets overruled, so to speak, in subsequent generations in terms of picking which Masorah to go with. That's not for now either. But just that's what the Mishnah is intending to do, to make a single set of opinions. When Rebbe writes down the Mishnah, or he at least formalized the Mishnah, that becomes known as the Mishnah with a capital M. So you'll see, again, I'll show you tomorrow, all the things I'll show you tomorrow in a very few sources, you'll see that the Tanaim had these traditions, which they called Mishnah. The Amoraim, I'll find those in a second, reflecting back on what the Tanaim taught, called all those things the Mishnayos. We differentiate. We now, since we have what was sort of formalized as the official set, as becomes the Mishnah with a capital M, and the stuff that's left out are generally called Brisos. Brisos. Brisos is all the other Tanai teachings that were left out of the official set. So the word Mishnah is just to repeat and applies to all of them. The word Brisa from the word bar means outside, left out of the canons. They were left out from the tradition. But many times the Brisos are relevant, and obviously much of the grist in the middle of the Gemara, the Talmud, is trying to reconcile Brisos with Mishnah. So that's a big issue. So Rebbe did a good job, but it needed further refinement. I just use two terms that I want to clarify. So Tanaim and Amoraim. So the Tanaim are the people that end with Rebbe. How far back they start is like a gray area. Okay, but sometime in Bayashem they started. It could be they started as early as like the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, but probably not then. But probably when they finish, the Zugos or Antigonos. It doesn't matter for now. A couple hundred years or so of people are called Tanaim. Yeah, it's a name that's like everything. It's a name that's used in retrospect. So, like today, you know, when did the Rishonim end and Achronim begin? It's a blurry thing. So, certainly, it's just used as definitive. Clearly, when the Mishnah is codified, we said that's it. That's the deal. And after that, we're not budging from that set of text or set of tradition. So, that is obviously a watershed event in Jewish history. And the people after the Mishnah are called Amoraim. Tana means. It's actually the same, like very much the same word as Mishnah. Just Shoneh is Hebrew, like to repeat and teach. And Tana, oftentimes the Shin comes to a stuff and the Hater and Sunalaf. Tana is basically like Shana, if you will, Shoneh. Like it's Tanaim were the teachers of by memory, if you will, in Aramaic. Amoraim are the explainers of that, those Mishnaic, lowercase m, you know, Mishnaic texts, Mishnas and the Brachos. So that's the Amoraim. And they go on. Loosely speaking, from the close of the Mishnah, again, it's such a blurry area because obviously people were alive. Which of Rebbe's, Rebbe Yehudah Tel Midim are considered Amoraim and Tanaim? There's a big discussion. Like the Mishnah we learned last night, the last Mishnah Uktin, there's a Shuban Levi, so it's a question if he's a Tana or a Amora, for example. Okay, and the Rambam says he's a Tana, others say he's an Amora. It's like a gray area. It doesn't matter really for now. When the Gemara is codified, after Ravina Ravashi, let's call the year 500 of the Common Era, so then Amoraim end and a new era begins. So basically, roughly speaking, our Mishnah as we have it was finalized around the year 188, 189. The tradition is 188 or so. If you call it 188, so just have some major milestones in your Jewish history, that comes out exactly at 500 years after the end of Nevuah and exactly 1500 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim. Okay, so it'll work out very nicely. So basically, very, very equal, clean breaks. You got 1,000 years of from Yetzias Mitzrayim until the end of Nevuah in the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. 500 years of Tanaim or Bayashani time, we'll call it, loosely speaking, and then begins Mishnah. Then begins the roughly it's what 300 years of the Amoraim and the Gemara period, something like that. Okay. Yes. Great. So now, on this sheet, which is the last thing I want to say today, there's actually another set of what are called I'm at the bottom now. Another set of things that are referred to as brisos, but they're actually different. In addition to brisos, there's something called tosefta. Okay? So tosefta nowadays, for most people, really most people, like Mishnah, Tosefta, Brisa. Well, I guess Brisa and Tosefta are all the same thing, so to speak. They're not really the same thing. There's a difference. A worthwhile difference. What? Yeah, so Brisa were left out. They're the left out version. But Brisa are old, meaning Brisa are... They're the same age as the Mishnah, just the Mishnah got the stamp. The Brisa, you know, the day, so to speak, the day before Rebbe Yehuda Nasi said, this is the Mishnah. They were all just Brisa. They were all just Mishnah, lowercase m. Then some were in the in club. They became the Mishnah, and the rest were Brisa, the left out club. In the next generation, one of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi's Talmidim, Rav Chia, wrote like the first supplement. Tosefta means supplement. So that's a good translation. First supplement to the Mishnah. So this is Jewish scholarship, always like this, right? It starts more and more, you know, perushim and explanation and expansion. Then someone says, this has become like a crazy, you know, untamed beast. We got to bring things back together again. That's what that story again and again. So what happens is the Tosefta is written by Rebbe Chia, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi's Talmud, as a supplement to the Mishnah. So the Tosefta are, you know, to clarify or elaborate or expand upon. Today in the Gemara, people in English will say a Brisa, Brisa, Brisa. But there is a difference in terms of weight, obviously, if you're really like a heavy-duty Talmudic scholar and you got to figure that one out. And the Gemara, even though I'm not sure what actually the practical differences for us is, maybe nothing, but the Gemara went to great lengths to clarify. We have, it says Tana Rabbanan or Tanya. Tana Rabbanan is a generic Brisa that everyone knew. The rabbi thought it, there's no name described. Tanya is a specific person said it, those are brisas. When it says Tani Allah or Tana, Tana is a verb, it's typically a Tosefta. The Gemara, as you probably noticed, like introduces these different Tanaic sort of, and Tanan, we learned in the Mishnah, from Masnis in our Mishnah. So they differentiate between the Mishnah, the Brisa, and the Tosefta, so we will at least, for once and for all, make that clear. But we're over for time for today, and Bez Hashem, tomorrow we will look at two sources, Rambam and Rashi, inside on these topics before we move on from there.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned Kol Hashona Halachas
B'chol Yom.
People think that that's talking about Halachas. That's really the Mishnah.
That's right.
Kol Hashona Halachas B'chol Yom Muftach Loshu B'chol Yom.
Right. That's exactly. That's Hashem. But not today. You got to do it on your own today. Yeah, sure. Make sure you're signed up. If you're on the sign-up sheet, that's important. And that's it. Jared. Oh, yeah? Okay, very good. Yeah, he's getting very serious.
What's his name again?
Yona,
yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. All time with the gym. We work out together.
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah, he's really into it.
So we edit this, our workout schedule with this, and we'll
fantastic. Okay, I love it. I love it. We got a gym group, we got a bike group, we got a mountain bike, a road bike, so. For sure. Take a pastry before you go, they're gonna go stale. Please.
Hey.
Thank you for mining. I did record it.
Yes.